My name is Alia. I'm at CKUT in Montreal, 90.3 FM. Keep on rocking in the free world.
Hello, this is a show from Radia. We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners. Each week we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond.
Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
Ha ha ha! could have melody or be amused. I can sing you tender songs of love. I can give you merry tales and joyous laughter. I can transport you music.
Thank you. working okay for you? I have no conception of where we're pointed or which way we go. Oh, crap and thing. There's a beautiful low pressure cell out here. Beautiful low pressure. Yeah, it's Hawaiian, huh? 128 is AOS. Buzz, how's it going? Am Monica giving good service?
Thank you. point within 97 geographical miles of the South Pole, the only thing that stopped us from reaching the actual point was the lack of 50 pounds of food. Another party reached for the first time the South Magnetic Pole. Another party reached the summit of a great active volcano, Mount Erebus. We made many interesting geological and scientific discoveries and had many narrow escapes throughout the whole time.
Immobilized, 30 miles down the loose, dirt road, the servant. Just about to be cut off by the lamp. Boy, does that ever look beautiful in the section.
Have you got
how about next sandwich?
You got it.
When Omni...
Down voice back up.
Bravo.
Thank you.
End of transmission. Find us on the internet, radia.fm. Over and out.
What's the matter? Is everything all right? That's okay. I've got just the right thing for you. KUT 90.3 FM.
Pangea de Futura is a mega jam collective comprised of many veterans of the Montreal music scene. A wide range of tectonic plates coming together, making the world stop for a second and ripping these continents apart. CKUT 90.3 FM is proud to present their concert in collaboration with CHYZ 94.3 on Sunday, May 22nd at 3 p.m. at the 38th Festival International de Musique Actuelle de Victoriaville. For all the details on the 38th FIMAV, visit fimav.qc.ca.
Hello, this is a show from Radia. We're a group of stations bringing new and forgotten ways of making radio to our listeners.
Delta 2 Yankee, Juliet Romeo.
Each week we give artists the challenge to make radio that works across the whole of Europe and beyond.
Delta 2 Yankee, Delta 2 Yankee, Juliet Romeo.
Are you up for it?
Since 1992, the program Mokrel's Law is broadcasted on Radio Panic in Brussels, the weekly adventure of conventional music. In more than 30 years, hundreds of creative people from all over the world have participated in the show. For the radio, we have dug into the archives and from the thousands of hours made a distillation of 25 minutes to illustrate the richness. Enjoy!
Just by chance, we met somebody who was coming over to travel to India, and they asked if they could stay for the evening. And we told them that we were looking to move. And she said, well, I live in Paradise in the west of Ireland, and there's a tiny little cottage that has to be sold. It's my neighbour's cottage. He's growing grass, and he's been caught by the police, the authorities, and he's done a runner to Portugal, and he's left his cottage, and he needs to sell it quick for cash. So Tibet, Diana Rogerson, and I got together with as much as we could. I can't remember what it cost now, but it was very little, really. And we bought this cottage, broken down cottage with a busted up asbestos roof, a horse shit floor, basically. And David only came over for a few days, and then maybe a week. But he immediately realised that he hated country life and he didn't like Ireland. And we didn't have a phone or anything, and he needed a telephone to survive. So he went back home and we stayed, and I learned how to become a builder.
Ring, ring, ring.
I'm a bit of a space person, you know? Like, I feel sometimes like I'm from outer space.
Today we were on Ryanair, and it was just like a comedy, you know what I mean? Like, it's a good story. I mean, we bought a ticket for the guitar, and then we got up to check in. They said, sorry, you can't take the guitar. Why? Because you can't check it in under your name. But whoever bought this said, I want to buy a ticket for a guitar. How do we do it? We pay this. No, that's not the rule. You have to write item Lindsay. Okay, so then can we change this? No. Can we buy a new ticket? No. You have to pay to change it. So then we went and probably paid more to change the ticket than we paid for everything else together, you know. Still wasn't that much money, you know, but, and then we got on the plane and we were in this exit row and the guy said, you can't have the guitar here. And we're like, but we bought this fucking ticket twice already, you know what I mean? And the guy said, I'm sorry, it's not my responsibility, but the plane is my responsibility. He was a nice guy. The people on the ground were, I don't know what they get, an extra sandwich or something from Ryanair for like, you know, making people spend more money. I don't know. It was kind of a drag.
Why?
A little bit lower.
How?
Eiko Ishibashi. So, could you help me? I asked to him, and he could he helped me.
You have the train, and then the comes, boom, and then, you know, we do all this. And then the parents, perhaps, if you live in a little apartment, say, well, shut up, perhaps, coming here in the plane from Oslo, and there was a little, I think, 3 years old, little black, did it sound incredible, so it was not this, I don't know, and she was searching for the sound, and searching for the sound, she said, perhaps the mother will not say anything, she will let it, and then, and I thought it was marvelous, I said, it was incredible, this kind. I think there's something with the tongue and with the. Something like that. And she was trying to change this and to do variations with this, a little thing like that. So she will be a composer. Yeah. And the home is
wow. Like to do a performance that was a live performance in London on the streets and also a live performance on the radio, but that would sound, you know, it would be two completely different things at the same time, in a way. Do you know what I mean? And so I would just walk around with my pushchair, with my little baby in the pushchair, and push him, and then play the sax with my left hand. And it would be transmitted live through my telephone. And so you could make feedback. That used to be nice. We'd go into a phone box, and I would read out the number, and then the listener could phone up the phone box. And because it was happening live, you would get a loop going through my phone and then to the radio station and then to their radio. And it was really good. It was nice.
To pass here regularly, like to see my friend. And so one day I met at one of their dinners, Aud Stockley, who I had already known a little bit because I knew her mother from her mother often gave champagne invitations at the Palais Stockley, and I knew a few of her relatives, sisters, and brother-in-laws over the years, from the years I was here in the 70s, but I'd never met her. And we met a couple times, and then we finally met at a dinner in 1998, and we've been together ever since now.
Ring, ring, ding, doo-doo, ring. Ring, whoa, 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 whoa.
There was one Sunday afternoon, my dad was playing records. It was raining outside. We couldn't really do anything. I was into music, but I didn't really know I was into music. And my dad played Every Time We Say Goodbye by Ella Fitzgerald. And his eyes, he sort of looked off into a space that wasn't there. And I'd never seen my dad be like that before. Before that, he'd always been a bloke with hammers and nails and putting up shelves. And suddenly, he was this guy who became quite sort of like he was in a sort of religious, you know, a church-like reverie. Yeah. That was the nearest I could identify it with as an 8-year-old kid. And it was like, wow, that's what music does.
Quite a walk here from the train station, that hill killed myself. It's like, I know how to get to St. Josie Node 10 from the central train station. I know how to do that.
I'm up here in the mountains here, so I had to go out around to find a good spot for the reception. But I'm standing out right now here in the olive tree plantation, so it's pretty good.
With the idea that they're going to be forgotten, and that's something that a lot of people kind of tend to not remember, was the idea of making art so that it will be forgotten. And then the internet came, and you're like, oh my goodness, nothing's going to get forgotten. I used to work at elementary school, which is really young kids, like 5 years old to 10 years old. So that's really young. They did catch word that I made music, but they were just totally confused. And I got this email from a kid who actually got a little bit older, but him and his buddies looked me up and they saw that I had a cassette from 1994 or three. It was a cassette from Japan, limited edition of like 50 copies or 100. Anyway, this cassette is called Furnace Fucker. Yeah. Anyway, so these kids, this is like about maybe like 5 years ago, they're like, hey, you are our librarian or elementary school, and listen, we're just like trying to figure out like what's going on with Furnace Fucker. So like, what is this type of, I mean, these are kids that are just brought up in the digital world. Their mother's milk is a USB cord. And I had to explain to them like, no, once upon a time, there was a time before the internet when you did stuff that was silly and ridiculous and didn't make any sense. And you just did it because it was fun. I wish I could tell kids it's okay to do silly things, but now you really can't because of the internet. The internet is this technological god that's always looking at down at you. If you're a child before the internet, and maybe you're raised on some form of Christianity, you know, there's always this thing like God is always looking at you. God is always judging you. God is always, you know, he's watching every move, every thought, everything. You're like, wow, that's really scary. I don't know if Christianity is really for me because there's a scary God that's always looking at me. And then the internet comes and you're like, no, actually, this is the real God. It's called the internet. It's always looking at you. It's always remembering you. Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Who knows? Who cares? The funny thing is that, you know, these kids are like discovering that I have like the one and only controversial recording. It's called Furnace Fucker. That means absolutely nothing. I just thought it was really funny. At the time,
I think it was Donald Miller was speaking to Lamont Young, and Lamont said, they say you're making god-awful noise now, but if you continue for 25 years, they'll realize you're serious about making god-awful noise.
I mean, some people are, maybe younger people are more, have another focus on this. For me, it's really difficult. That's why I stopped also. I mean, I have still a lot of invitations to play a making podcast, and can you make a mix from all over the world, you know, and I always say, hey, fuck, I don't see myself anymore as a DJ, and I think there's so many mixes every day, it's like, phew, who can listen to all this stuff, you know, and there's so much interesting music, of course, there are a lot of clever young people, they can do it better than me, you know, I made it already, I want to give it up, you know, I don't care anymore. Really, I'm not excited anymore about, I have this record and I can play this track, and no energy anymore for this, really.
The difference from scatology to post-rovia is enormous. It's what I love about Coil, and it's what I think other people love about Coil, is that you can't point to any one thing and say that that's what Coil sound like, you know, that it's a it's a constant change. There's a unifying something, you know, that threads its way throughout all of Coil's work. You know, it's hard to say what that is, but, you know it when you hear it. There are no two Coil albums that sound even remotely similar to each other.
Pauline said, you know, Elliot, and music should be listened to with your eyes closed, and your music is for listening to with your eyes open.
Don's is like branches cracking in the wood under the weight of a huge mastodon or something. And Zappa's music's sort of very intellectual and put together, and, you know, to me, and in a lot of kind of like poo-poo caca lyrics sometimes. It didn't hit me the same way. It didn't, you know, it didn't stab me in the heart. But nevertheless, it's like, ooh, Frank Zappa. And, you know, Don would just be kind of, he would tell me all these stories about how they were, had been really good friends, but now they were kind of enemies. He was mad at him, and, you know, that Frank would still throw out the olive branch and want to be friends. Me, in a certain way, not really knowing anything and being 23 years old, I would kind of say to Don, like, friends are really important. Maybe you should try to, you know, go hang with him and see if he's nicer and stuff. And he'd say, okay. And so but he would take me with him. And we'd go over to this house in L.A. on Laurel Canyon Drive, just off of it on this other street. And, you know, I kind of go over there, and, you know, Frank would always greet him very warmly and not even barely notice that I was in the room. And why should he? I realize now. But it just wasn't particularly warm and friendly like Don had always been. And, you know, because Don would bring me over and say, like, this is my friend Eric. He's in my band now and things like that. And Frank could have cared less. And then he would go and come back with a cup of tea for Don. And then they would start talking. And then maybe he would look at me after a couple of minutes and say, oh, did you want something? You know, I immediately knew this guy wasn't for me. That's all.
J'aime l'improvisation. C'est un vrai sujet. Mais pas que pour un musicien, hein, on n'arrête pas d'improviser. Toute la journée, on improvise. Toute la journée. On ne se rend pas compte, il y a des gens qui ont une pensée, dans, je ne sais pas comment on peut appeler ça. On improvise. Donc, l'improvisation est un art. L'art d'improviser, c'est toute une vie. D'ailleurs. Et du coup, ça devient politique, philosophique. C'est un chemin qui questionne la vie. C'est un sujet de vie. Donc j'appelle l'improvisation. Je suis une improvisatrice. Je m'offris savoir. Personne n'est libre, on n'est pas libre. C'est utopique, c'est l'utopie totale. Mm-hmm. On peut être attiré, tendance à, mais on n'est pas libre. C'est pas possible. Par contre, je suis dans un chemin un peu rebelle, ou un chemin, quand on ne prend pas le vrai chemin, comment on peut appeler ça, outsider, on dit.
Il y avait un copain qui s'appelait Gunther Wüsthof, qui est aussi un membre de créateur de Faust. Et lui, il a fait un héritage, soit lui, soit sa femme, je ne sais pas. En tout cas, sa femme n'était pas là. Lui, il avait un appartement à Hambourg. Tac. À l'époque, tu sais, dès que quelqu'un avait un appartement, paf, tout le monde allait vivre dedans. Tu vois, il y avait c'était un peu un phénomène tout à fait courant. Et alors, on vivait un peu à droite, à gauche, mais on avait en communauté, parfois on couchait là, parfois on couchait ailleurs, mais on venait souvent chez Gunther Wüsthof. Et c'est là qu'on a commencé, Gunther et moi-même, ainsi que d'autres, mais qui sont moins importants, on a commencé à faire de la musique, à faire des trucs, et ensuite il est venu Rudolf Zosner. Et c'est là que Faust a commencé à prendre forme.
À San Francisco, j'étais chez des hippies. Le père était le médecin des Black Panthers. C'est eux qui m'ont emmené au Fillmore. Ils m'ont fait fumer mes premiers pétards. Ils m'ont donné des graines que j'ai fait pousser sur mon balcon en rentrant en France. À l'époque, personne ne fumait. Hein. J'étais un héros. Là, au lycée, personne n'allait aux États-Unis non plus. Quand je suis rentré, j'étais adulte parce qu'il nous est arrivé aussi des choses angoissantes. On a été confronté à l'extrême droite américaine, on a été confronté à la violence américaine, à coups de flingue, etc. On s'est retrouvé des fois dans des situations assez étonnantes, mais c'était en 68. Flower power, aujourd'hui, ce serait plus possible, me disent tous les Américains. Même si c'était impossible déjà à l'époque, l'époque même en France, si tu veux. Que mon premier festival, je l'ai vécu en Belgique, c'était le festival d'Amougy, puisqu'il avait été interdit en France, octobre 69. Et je pouvais laisser mon sac à dos avec mes papiers, mon fric, mon magnétophone au milieu de la tente où se passaient tous les concerts pour aller faire ma toilette sans avoir peur qu'on me vole. Et je disais toujours un chevelu, parce que j'avais laissé pousser mes cheveux, je ne peux pas me faire voler par un autre hippie. Il y avait une sorte de morale peace and love qui n'a rien à voir évidemment avec ce qui s'est passé ensuite.
For one year. On a commune in 1970. This was the transition year for me between trying to be a normal university person and trying to deal with music. You know, this was like, how could I make this change, you know? At the same time, it was 1970. You understand it was the time of the alternative culture was very strong. There were communes, quite a lot of communal action happening around America. And what are called the hippies were definitely happening here and there, you know? I was not really a hippie in my way, but I wanted to do something different. And I didn't know if I wanted to be a musician yet. I wanted to try something different. So I found out about this commune in Virginia and wrote some letters. And the woman who started it was an idealist, a kind of a utopian dreamer. She said to me, the reason for this commune is one reason only, is to we want to be together so we can break the linkage between work and money. And I said, wow. That's a great idea. I want to do that too. I want to break the linkage between work and money. Well, she said, yeah, that's what we want to do. We want people to do what they love and not have to worry to be paid for it. Meanwhile, they can do some other work, some work that needs to be done. That's part of to keep the commune alive. And it doesn't take up their whole life. They don't work 100 hours a week. They work 10 hours a week or 15 hours a week to make the commune alive. And the rest of it work is for their own love. And that was the basic philosophy of this commune, to try to develop a larger community of this, about this. So I went there. I moved there for 1 year. And, you know, it was another life-changing experience. I was, strangely enough, I was there for a year, and I was every night by myself with my drums in my little room, a little garage room that was mine, with my drums and my electric piano and 500 records and my record player. I put my headphones on, and until 2 or 3 in the morning, I would practice drums with John Coltrane. I mean, I was really kind of obsessed in a certain way. I was living on a commune in the countryside with lots of people, with pigs and goats and animals and vegetarian and all that stuff. And then on the other side, I was staying awake till 2 or 3 in the morning playing, improvising with Coltrane. It was kind of a weird split of life. Okay. But it was okay. It was important. And at the same time, I realized I was clear that there was more to life than just Coltrane and drumming. There was what other people wanted, these people who were living on the commune trying to share a different philosophical idea of non-capitalistic lifestyle, you know, which I agreed with and was happy to be part of. To do my job in the commune, I was a teacher, but they didn't like the word teacher. They had a word for teacher in this commune. They called us, we were the be theirs. We were there. We'd be there for every, our job was to be there for the young people. So we were there. I was there. I spent all of my day from 9 in the morning till 4:30 in the afternoon. I was there in my drum room, in the library, sitting outside, wherever. I was there, and any kid could come to me and ask me or tell me or try to get me involved or whatever, and I would do it. I was there. And or if I was doing something, the kids could come over to me and watch me and ask me, and I would show them and whatever, you know. And that was my job, as a be there for the kids. It was a really lovely job and pleasure to do. At the same time, the desire to jump into music was very strong, and I found myself looking at the newspaper to see which musicians were playing nearby. Like, for example, we were in the state of Virginia, 2 hours south of Washington, D.C. And I would look in the Washington newspapers to see which musicians were playing. Like Miles Davis came to Washington. I said, oh, I have to go hear Miles Davis, you know. Nobody in the commune had heard of Miles Davis, you know. But David wants to go to see Miles Davis. Okay, we'll drive him into Washington to see Miles Davis, you know, whatever. The desire to do the music was strong. And so after 1 year, I realized I had to make my change. It was necessary. And by complete chance, a friend from college had gone up to Bennington and had met Bill Dixon and was playing with Bill Dixon. And this friend wrote me a letter or called me and said, David, you should come up here. He doesn't have a good drummer. He could really use a good drummer. He needs someone to play his music. The students aren't good enough, and he really needs someone. I did that. I got in my truck and packed up all my records and my drums and my dog and drove up to Bennington, Vermont, and
call it up on
when
Apple
the
Music
world
there,
is
sure.
Our friend.
It was mostly about
when our
about.
Friends
about.
Are the world. When the world is the world, and our friends are our friends.
When the world's our friend, and a friend's our world, and the world's the world, and a friend's our friends, and world, and friend, friend, world,
just
friend, world, friend.
Refugee, from that dust bowl to the peach bowl, now that peach buzz is killing.
Yeah. You know, the air that we breathe is gonna be really
right.
Silly.
Let's get on that plane.
Yeah. To go entertain people.
Yeah, oh, it's important about the environment. Let's go play destroying anything. Let's fly another couple hundred miles to encourage ecotourism.
We could offset our emissions.
What's to be done? And the only way to defend ourselves from what we've created is to merge with it.
Through
through sheer accident, I ended up living on Beck Road in Hackney with a bunch of roommates. And so I lived at number 12 Beck Road, and Beck Road is where Genesis lived. So Genesis lived like down the street from me at number 56. And David Tibet lived at number 4.
Oh.
And then across the street at number 11 were the people that ran Operation Twilight, which was the British arm of Crepuscule Records. So yeah, I'd see them, you know, I'd see the Psychic Youth tramping down the street on their way to number 56 Beck Road. And I'd run into Genesis at the Sun Bazaar office, and then that's where I hung out with Jeff Rushton, and eventually they asked me to produce the Coil album, the Coil album Scatology.
We were nervous, but it went well. They put us in rotation, which was how it was in those days. You got to play in CBGBs basically every month. We were a hardworking band. I think it was fairly common in those days so we could concentrate on the music, and we were rehearsing. At least 5 days a week we were rehearsing. That's a luxury I've never had since then. Huh? So we were changing very quickly. I mean, we had maybe 3 shows where we were playing, you know, the same songs. And then they would start changing. It was becoming, you know, more radical. So yeah, we were very driven.
Ah, they didn't like it at all. Yeah, yeah. So that was a big conflict. And I was not listening to them. I left home and I left the country, and so they couldn't do much. Actually, I don't think it's more difficult to leave than to stay, because staying in Japan was very difficult for women or for artists, for musicians. It's very difficult. So it wasn't so difficult actually, really. But of course, they have some specific expectations. And there's a huge generation gap between my generation and my parents' generation. It's hard for both. I made a kind of radical choice, and the others don't. I think for women, it's maybe easier, because in Japan, I mean, the men, they have to succeed the family, kind of. And especially if you are the first boy, you know. So as I was a woman, I had maybe less pressure in the family, yeah, mm-hmm. And because I was supposed to marry and marry someone and leave home, you know. So the pressure is less for women actually. So that's also why you see lots of female Japanese living in Europe or abroad, you know.
Crossing from Czech Republic to Hungary back in the day with Tom Cora. And 2 days earlier, we had been trying to spend money, because you're not allowed to take money out of a communist country. So he had bought an accordion. The car broke down, and we had to wait 2 hours while they went to fetch a mechanic. And we learned a song on accordion and violin, a Jelly Roll Morton tune. And so then we arrived 2 days later. We're crossing from Czech Republic into Hungary at 1 o'clock in the morning. And it's skeleton crew, so we have all of this equipment. They've taken all the equipment out of the car, and they look at all this equipment, and they think, these are not musicians. They are smuggling instruments. Yeah. So then the guy says, okay, if you're a musician, play.
Play one.
And the only thing we could do, because all the stuff had to be plugged in and set up and out, but he pulls out the accordion, and I pull out the violin, and we play the tune we just learned 2 days ago. And then the guy said, okay.
Okay, it's good. Okay, let's go.
So Jelly Roll Morton got us into Hungary.
I was driving up to London one day, and there was a van went in front of me on a junction, one of these fast food vans, and it was hamburgers and hot dogs and some lettuce, had literally, and it did say Hambu Hodo.
Ronaldo and the Loaf just showed up at the door one day with some tapes, and, you know, I was the one actually who listened to their demo tapes and loved them. I thought they were great. So, you know, things work out different ways.
End of transmission. Find us on the internet, radia.fm. Over and out.
Okay, vous écoutez CKUT 90 3 à Montréal.
Okay, oh, merci beaucoup.
Black Rose Books invites you to our book launch event.
Confronting Canada's Past and Europe's Forgotten Revolutions.
Happening on Sunday, May 22nd, featuring the authors and editors of
Stand on Guard for Whom?
The Fire That Time.
Insatiable Hunger.
The Forgotten Revolution.
And Black Ukraine Yesterday and Today.
Join us on live stream or in person at 2 p.m.
at the Cité des Hospitalières, 251 Pine West, Corner Park.
Free tickets are available at blackroselaunch.eventbrite.ca or visit blackrosebooks.com for more information.
This event is co-presented with the Cité des Hospitalières en Transition and CKUT-FM.
Data, our data. When you're not paying for a product, you are the product. Especially in web and email services, where multinationals compete to manage your communication so they can make a profit off of the private communication you are producing. Coombit is a worker cooperative trying to help small organizations or individuals get their email, website creation, and website hosting services off corporate services such as Google. For more information, contact us at coombit.org or email at info@coombit.org. That's K-O-U-M-B-I-T. We are not on Facebook.
Pangea de Futura is a mega jam collective comprised of many veterans of the Montreal music scene. A wide range of tectonic plates coming together, making the world stop for a second and ripping these continents apart. CKUT 90.3 FM is proud to present their concert in collaboration with CHYZ 94.3 on Sunday, May 22nd at 3 p.m. at the 38th Festival International de Musique Actuelle de Victoriaville. For all the details on the 38th FIMAV, visit fimav.qc.ca.
It's finally time to bring back smiles, all of them. Shy smiles, carefree smiles, ear-to-ear pearly white flashers, polite smiles, nervous smiles, knowing smiles, and kind smiles. Wearing a mask is no longer mandatory in Quebec, except on public transit, in healthcare facilities, and in the days following your isolation period if you had COVID-19. Feel free to keep wearing one if you feel the need, and do it with a smile. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
Yes, sir, you already know what it is.
What it is.
Ladies and gentlemen in the city of Montreal and worldwide, if you're tuned in online, welcome back to CKUT 90.3. This is THT Entertainment. With that show, you know, gives you the best Canadian content you've never